Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, Fantasy Focus Football. They tape every morning, Monday through Friday, live on Twitter. Be sure to check it out if you're interested in the very best analysis in the game, or if you're just ashamed of how you did last year in your own league. You can download and subscribe to Fantasy Focus Football now, as well as The Right Time, wherever you get your podcast. The Right Time with Bomani Jones podcast is presented by Goodyear. Drive always discovers possibilities. Goodyear, more driven. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcasts. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. Coming up on this episode of The Right Time, we're going to talk about John Thompson. Going to talk a little bit about what's going on in college football, the story I wrote for Vanity Fair. Also, we're going to do a send-off for Chadwick Boseman. But first... All right, Gabe, as you know, and a couple of other people know, I turned 40 last week. My 40th birthday was August the 26th, which is also, by the way, Macaulay Culkin's 40th birthday.
Yeah, I did see that. Like, want to make you feel old?
Yes.
Turning 40.
How yes. About that? Yes, yes. We are birthday twins in that way. Shout out to the homie Big Crit. He turned 34. Shout out to James Harden, who turned 31. That is the August 26th crew, and it's about time to rename August 26th. It has been a national holiday for the longest. It's my birthday, a.k.a. International Baba Day. Long story for those of y'all who don't know. But anyway, we need to start calling it Revolution Day, baby. Gabe, it seemed like people were like, yo, it's Bomani's birthday, man. Let's get this revolution cracking. 2016, that was the day that everybody realized that Colin Kaepernick wasn't standing for no stinking national anthem. Remember that? That was on August 26th. And then this year on August 26th is when the Milwaukee Bucks were like, nah, dog, we ain't playing. And then everybody else had to say, they ain't playing.
Coincidence? Not a coincidence.
I'm just saying, man. I can understand why they would be so inspired under those circumstances.
That's right.
You know what I'm saying? But it was a lot. It was a lot that jumped off. And then we found out there was that meeting that night that LeBron James wound up walking out of. And apparently went so bad that somebody called Stephen A. and was like, yo, man, y'all got to check this dude. And so Stephen A. got on First Take, I think it was on Friday, and explained how the younger dudes were turned off by the way that LeBron was getting down in that meeting. And we later got reports about LeBron. I mean, not even reports. He said it himself. He was like, they didn't have no plan, so I just walked out. And then he said the next day, so I woke up and I came up with a plan. Right? And I've seen other people make mention to another interview we did where he said, we all came together. We came to do this or whatever. But I saw that quote with my own eyes given to Joe Varden of The Athletic, who is one of LeBron's guys, right? I don't know if that was a scrum interview or individual, right? But Joe Varden is a dude he talks to. And he said, I came up with a plan. In that same article, Varden talked to Giannis, and Giannis was like, I was out there and I was like, me being a leader, we're not going to do this because I, as a leader, and I was like, oh boy, y'all are going real first person singular with this situation. Bottom line, at least as far as I can tell from here, you tell me if I'm wrong, seemed like George Hill was the real guy that was at that place in Milwaukee that went ahead and pushed this. It also sounds very much that LeBron's problem here was, ain't nobody tell me first. Okay. And by the way, I know there are other people in the league, not just him, who felt like LeBron got burned by the fact that the Bucks did not run this by him or by the rest of the league. Because LeBron, and this is where I think there's an argument. The argument is that LeBron had pushed so hard to get them into the bubble, and basically he gave Adam Silver, I think, the assurance that we're going to be here in this bubble and we're going to be the ones to make it happen, right? And so then all of a sudden he sees himself as being blindsided in the situation. I could kind of see that if LeBron sees himself as the leader, the guy that got these guys into the bubble, right? But I don't agree with him. I think that for him to view it in that context is selfish. And I think that it is a bit arrogant and narcissistic. And this is why I'll say that. And I want to be clear. I do think that the Bucks had a part they didn't think out in this, but it doesn't sound like this was a premeditated situation. This sounds like it got to a point and it was before the game, and then somebody just looked around and was just like, man, this, we ain't doing it. You know, like it just got to that point of frustration where they're like, yo, we're not going to do this. And before I get to explaining that part, I want to explain the dynamic of the bubble from people I've talked to who are in and around it. Like, we call this a bubble, but I don't think that we grasp enough the reality that it is one, that we do have all these people in this place trapped with nothing to do, right? Like, they're just there. They're around the same people all the time, many of whom they don't necessarily like that much. And even some of the ones they like, they ain't supposed to be spending all that time around them, right? So they're in there. They're separate from their families. Ain't been so much TV that you can wind up watching. So what do you think those dudes are in there doing? They living on their phones. The social media feeds are their connection to the outside world. Like, I had the jokes for Paul George when he turned off comments on his Instagram. And I was just like, why are you reading the comments, so forth and so on? But the part that I really didn't think about until he himself talked about, like, feeling depressed and stuff like that, is if you have a bad game in the bubble and you're somebody like Paul George, you can't get away from this. Like, there's no escape for it whatsoever. And then all you got is tens of thousands of people bombarding you, telling you directly how terrible you are, right? Like, my man Wright Thompson works at ESPN. He said, when he got rid of social media, got rid of Twitter, he was like, why am I just making it easier for people to me all the time, right? And that stuck with me. That's something that I'll remember for a very long time. It even affected my social media behavior in a lot of ways. Like, you'll find I don't really be going back and forth with people like that anymore, because it's like, yo, why am I just letting people do this? Like, it wouldn't hurt my feelings necessarily, but it doesn't mean that I got to let them do it. And so Paul George is just in the bubble with people him all the time, right? Like, I get it. I can see how that would be a debilitating sort of situation for him. But now let's take this to another place. What's the predominant topic on these dudes' timelines? Is Jacob Blake getting killed at Kenosha? Like, they're taking all of this in. And if they so decide that they want to say something about it, they're getting back all the bots, and they're getting back all the racists, and they're getting back everything, everybody else telling them to shut up and all of this stuff. And just imagine what must be building up inside these cats, what must be burning inside these cats as all of these things happen. And so I totally see how they got in there. I was like, nah, we just not going to play. And keep in mind, and this is why I think it's important to remember, it's the Milwaukee Bucks, okay? If the Orlando Magic had said, we're not going to play, I would get the argument that they should have run that by somebody. But this was Milwaukee's issue, right? Like, for them, this is local. This is in their backyard. This is in their neighborhood. They're the team with Sterling Brown on it, right? John Henson doesn't play for them anymore, but they're the team where John Henson had the situation to go into the jewelry store and then somebody called the cops on him. Like, you couldn't figure out why this 6'10 dude might be in. Like, I wonder what he's doing here. What else you think he's doing? He played for the Bucks. I mean, even if there's a 6'10 dude just walking around Milwaukee that ain't got no money, hell no, they all play basketball. It's the only reason you be there, right? But anyway, it's that team. This means something different to them. This is a different place for them. And so if they individually decided that they just didn't want to play, I get that. I think that everybody around should have very easily understood that it should have meant something different for them. All right? The problem, and what they didn't think about, was Orlando could not take the forfeit. Right? Like, that was their thing. Their thing was just like, fine, we'll take the forfeit. And trust me, somebody on the Magic was like, I mean, sounds good to me. You know what I'm saying? Like, how many wins we gonna be able to get out here fair and square? You know what I'm saying? Like, no, man, somebody on that team was like, fine, dude, I'll take it. You remember when they took the Heisman for Reggie Bush and Vince Young was like, I'll take it if you don't want it. Somebody out here wanted this W, but you know, men of pride and all of that, they couldn't do that. That wasn't an option. And so what that meant was, the Bucks could say this was our neck of the woods, but the Magic, they're not the ones that's out here saying it's their neck of the woods. And it would really, really look bad for them if they did not play. And so now, once the Magic decides they're not going to play, then nobody else can play. And then the next day, all those other teams, they all feel like they got to say, we not going to play, because they needed to look like they was down for it too. But I personally believe that the only team under that circumstance that it was Milwaukee. If everybody else played and Milwaukee did not, I don't think that would have made the rest of them look bad. At least it would not have made the rest of them look bad in my eyes, right? I also think that it's a bit self-absorbed of those guys to be that concerned with how it makes you look, right? A little bit. Now, on the flip side is, like, I've had to explain before to a woman I was dating that very independent type, you know, and so if you go to the store and she gets a bunch of stuff and it's a big bag, she'll carry it and just, you'll be walking with her, right? And I'm like, yo, I can't be the dude that's out here walking next to you while you carry this with nothing in my hand. You know what I mean? It's not a good look. And so I get on a level why those guys felt that way, you know? But I want to talk specifically about LeBron, okay? Because I think he's making a lot of bad plays right now. And he's making bad plays that are going to alienate him from his colleagues. And they're going to alienate him from the guys who are younger than him in the league, the ones that he sees himself as being the leader of. He's playing this all bad. And we're getting reports out here again that the young guys were real turned off by what his get down was and real turned off by the fact that he walked out of that meeting. And I'm not as confident in saying this part, but I've heard enough to feel a little bit confident saying, also a little turned off by the idea that LeBron got it out there that he had called Obama, and Obama had given them this advice about turning the arenas into voting centers or whatever it was. It is clearly very important for LeBron to center himself as being the person that's in front of this. And I understand on a number of levels, aside from simple narcissism, why he would want to be that guy. And I think a big part of why he'd want to be that guy is because he's that guy on everything else, right? Remember when Patrick Beverly said, look, LeBron said we hooping, we hooping. Okay? LeBron is the guy that's at the front of the league. He is the guy that is at the front of the players, but that doesn't necessarily translate to being the guy that's at the front of the movement or being the guy that's at the front of the revolution. This ain't really no revolution, but you understand what I'm saying. Those things don't translate the same way. And what we've seen from LeBron over the years in terms of that positioning, like, Gabe, have you seen that meme the person put up on the internet about how LeBron loves the first page of all these books? And that every time LeBron says he's starting a book, there's always a picture of him reading the book, but he's always at the very beginning.
That was hilarious to me. It was hilarious to me. And then LeBron might have posted a picture of him doing something else other than reading. Right. And Master quote tweeted it and said, damn, man, just read the book.
Yeah. Yeah. But also, like, LeBron made a bad play with the autobiography of Malcolm X. Right. And the reason he made a bad play was you don't tell people in your 30s that you read it for the first time. You understand what I mean? Like, this is a book that people read in their teens, by and large. And I'm not judging him for the fact that he, like, I ain't never seen Roots, right? Just never got around to it, you know? I don't judge him for the fact that he hasn't read it, but you can't tell people that you're reading the autobiography. The people who are going to be impressed by the fact that you're reading the autobiography of Malcolm X are going to look at you and be like, damn, just now? You know what I mean? But he's trying to make himself look like that guy. He's been in this place in the public eye for so long that everything is branded and everything is positioned. I'm not saying this really in a judgmental way about him. I understand why it is the way that it is, but it's indisputable. Like, he's Truman in the Truman Show. You know, we've talked about that for years, that he's always had all these cameras and all these lights on him and everything else. And somewhere along the way, he decided that he wanted to be the Muhammad Ali of his generation. Right? Like, somewhere he decided that he wanted to be that guy. And the dude doesn't understand that he, in 2020, cannot be Muhammad Ali. He cannot do it. And there are two reasons why he cannot be Muhammad Ali. Reason number one as to why he cannot be Muhammad Ali, all right? LeBron's not a radical. Like, this is a very, very important distinction to make here. Muhammad Ali was a radical. The dude stared down the draft board and said, I ain't going, okay? Like, Ali's out here referring to the government and to white people as the oppressors. He's out here rolling with the Nation of Islam, out here calling them devils. I don't recall Ali calling them devils, but the people he was riding with were out here calling them devils. He was kicking it with literally the scariest black people in America as far as most white people were concerned. That's who he was out here with. That's who his squad was. The ideas that he was talking about and pushing. You can't both sides those, right? Ali did things that cost him for a significant portion of time his career. All right? LeBron ain't doing that. And hey, look, I'm not judging LeBron for not doing that. But we got to be clear about this. LeBron ain't doing that, right? Like, one thing, this is something about me personally. And I'm not trying to center myself in this, but I feel like I'm in a position where I can give you some light as to what it is that I'm talking about. And I think that this point is very important. I think it's something that if LeBron heard, I think would kind of help him understand things just a little bit better. So as I've talked to you guys about before, my parents both had significant roles in the civil rights movement. Like, maybe not in the way that you're going to see them like in the Eyes on the Prize documentary necessarily. But my mother, when she was 15 years old, was the leader of a student sit-in movement in Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, that predates Greensboro and everything else. Like, this is the first one that's led by students. She was at the front of it. The way I describe this for people to put it in better context, when Kanye talked about on that track, you know, at the 10 day to six, she was arrested in the sit-ins about his mom. I'm talking about those sit-ins. Like, that's what we're talking about. My mom's at the front of those. My father was expelled from college in the early 1960s for a sit-in movement in Baton Rouge. And they got put out like at the behest of the governor. All right. Some of the people over the course of time that I have met through my father, like the man who coined the phrase Black Power, not Stokely Carmichael, but Stokely Carmichael's man, Willie Ricks. For some of my Atlanta folks, you may know him as Mukasa on the streets of the West End. That was one of my preschool teachers, man. You know, I know cats that have taken land to form their own nation within the United States, like Republic of New Africa. I know those dudes. You know, I could tell you about sitting around on Christmas Eve at a dude named Ed Brown's house. You may know Ed Brown's brother Rap, like H-Rap. Like, I know who the real, like, gangsters are in this. I know who the real revolutionaries are in this gang. And I'm not one of them. Right? Like, as much as, like, I have intellectual things to offer, but I understand and I recognize that I exist in a space, and I exist in a way that carries a certain level of protection of what I got and risk minimization that makes me different than those dudes, all right? I'm not saying I'm not judging myself for it or anything like that, but I'm aware I am not them. I've seen the things that people have done. I've seen the grind that they put in. I've seen the risks that they have taken, okay? That's not me. Like, maybe at some point I'll be that, but I recognize that that is not me. And the way that I look at those people is the way that LeBron has to look at Muhammad Ali and recognize you are not him. Are you prepared to give it all up for this? And the answer for LeBron is obviously no, right? You're not. And I don't necessarily judge you for this, but you not willing to set it all on fire in order to make this happen. You not willing to take the risk that Ali took in order to make it happen. And again, neither am I. So I'm not offering this from a position of judgment. But LeBron needs to view this with a certain measure of self-awareness. You are not Muhammad Ali. Okay? As much as you might want the props for being Muhammad Ali, you are not Muhammad Ali because you don't see the world through the same lens that Muhammad Ali sees the world. You just don't. And I'll give you an example on this, right? So, you know, there's all these people gave to get out here and get on LeBron about the, well, you had a chance to say something about China. You ain't say nothing about China. You know, if you want me to believe or care about violence against Black people from the police, then you got to stand up for the Chinese too. And you know my feeling for everybody who says that, which is very simple. You. And here's the reason why it's them. Because LeBron James went into that arena in Brooklyn that night where they wore those I Can't Breathe t-shirts. You remember that? And that was a strong move, right? They made a strong public statement about the matter. But LeBron was in Cleveland when 12-year-old Tamir Rice was killed by the police. And you may not remember that case, but if you don't remember it, the reminder is a kid was in a playground playing with a toy gun. Somebody called 911 and said, hey, there's a kid out here. I think he's just playing. Like, I don't think he's doing anything, but he's got what seems to be a gun. And the caller reiterated, I don't think it's a problem, but I think I should call. Cops rolled up, kid's playing with the gun. Before the car even stopped, cops shot him twice. This happened in Cleveland. All right? In Cleveland. LeBron never said a word about it. Never did. All right? And I don't judge him for that. He had just gotten back to town, right? He just got back to Cleveland. The relationship is tenuous. Who knows exactly how it goes? Who knows if he helps anything by doing this, right? But it was a business decision. I don't think there's any question that that was a business decision that he made around that. And so all these people that all of a sudden, I can't listen to LeBron no more because he ain't say nothing about China, right? He ain't really about principle. He's about his money. None of y'all said a word about that when he didn't say nothing about a little boy getting shot in the city that he plays in. Y'all ain't say a word about that. And you know why? Because you think his money was worth more than that little boy. Whether you want to say that out loud or not, that's all that can come down to. Because if your argument is, I no longer think LeBron is standing on principle, that was within the same damn issue. And he could not stand on the principle, or more accurately, did not stand on the principle within that. And I ain't see a single one of these what about China concern trollers say nothing about him not saying a thing about this 12-year-old in his own backyard getting killed. None of y'all said a word about that, all right? But again, I get it. It was a business decision. And he decided that for whatever reason, that wasn't his fight. And he gets to decide that's not his fight. And the willingness to take on one fight does not necessarily require you to come out here and take on every single fight. I 100% get that. But the reason that LeBron wants to be Muhammad Ali, the reason we remember Muhammad Ali, is that in that moment, Muhammad Ali would not have made a business decision. And that's just not you. And that's fine. I'm not saying a bad word about him. But Muhammad Ali, hey, he had a chance to make a business decision. And he did not, when the most dire of circumstances, right? And I want to tell you something. While I'm telling you that I'm not judging LeBron on this, I want to explain to you part of why, and this comes from my father, again, who, I mean, if you've ever listened to me talk about my father, I revere my parents in an uncommon way, I suppose. Look, man, it's a lot. But anyway, my dad said something in an interview once that I thought was really, really interesting. And he said that one thing that he has stopped doing over the years, he says, is that he's not nearly as judgmental of people who make some of these business decisions that come out there. Because he said he was talking about when he got put out of college, and he said that he really, really harshly judged the president of the school. And he said he judged the president of the school because he believed that, look, man, the stakes are the stakes, right? You do what's right, and it don't matter what comes on the back end. You do what's right. And he said he now understands that things aren't really that simple. And the thing he said was, now I've gotten older and I've had time to think about that a little more, and I suppose my views are tempered a little bit. But I came out of his expulsion with the understanding, and I didn't have the understanding before, because again, my own father was a figure that, and I had known situations in which the risks were dire indeed, but he would draw the line, and I assume that you did that and you dealt with the consequences, right? So even my father, who felt that way in his own moments, can step back and look at these things and say, nah, people got different things they got to do, right? So I want to be clear to you. I'm not judging LeBron by saying that he's not radical enough to be Muhammad Ali, but he's not a radical, so you can't be Muhammad Ali, period. Now, here's the other reason why he can't be Muhammad Ali. And this is going to be the trickiest one. He's too old to be Muhammad Ali. Like, one thing we don't really do is we don't think about LeBron as being old, and we shouldn't. He's 35 years old, right? Like, that does not add up to being old per se. However, how old was Muhammad Ali when he stood up to the draft board? How old was he when he had his boxing license stripped? He was 25. He's 25 years old. Like, when Ali won the championship in 1964? He's 23. Or 22. Like, he's at a different age at that point. LeBron's 35 with all these kids and everything else. Ali, that ain't where he was. He was at a much different place in his life than LeBron was. And he didn't have all this money. He didn't have all these things to protect. He didn't have all these business relationships. And he had the fire of somebody in their early 20s. That's not where LeBron is. LeBron, by the way, he had a chance to be Ali in his early 20s if he wanted to be. You remember that time that Ira Noble came to him in the locker room when he played for the Cavs with the petition about, for Nike because of their relationship, what was going on in Darfur in Sudan? And LeBron was like, no, I need to research a little more. I need to think about this a little more. No shade, man. You know, you got all this money tied up with Nike. Those are your business partners. I totally understand. I got no judgment for LeBron in the course of doing that. But that was the time to make an Ali move. That was the age to make an Ali move. Look around at all these things that we've seen happen in these places. The people who are at the front of pushing these things, how many of them are 35 years old? You know, like, I don't know exactly who the faces of, like, the Black Lives Matter organization are or stuff like that. But, like, when you look at within these corporations, the people who have been making these pushes to get things changed, those people aren't in there. Those people aren't LeBron's age. Those people have been younger. Those are the ones who have a tendency to power these sorts of things. So think about this. I don't know if you guys have seen King in the Wilderness. It's an HBO documentary about when Martin Luther King went to Chicago. It's about the last 18 months of his life. And so we're talking about late 1966 through early 1968. So late 1966, Martin Luther King is 37 years old. And one of the things, and keep in mind, late 1966, like, we're 1 year after the Voting Rights Act, right? So it's not like King was, like, wildly irrelevant at that point. But late 1966, early 1967, they got clips in that doc of King and Stokely Carmichael, because now the push was coming from Stokely and the push was coming from Rap and all of those dudes who felt like it was time for a more militant movement, that they'd gotten as far as they could with the nonviolence. And one of the most fascinating things about it was they'd show King and Stokely walking, like, in a march, and there'd be a reporter walking in between them. And the reporter would ask Stokely a question, and Stokely had all the fire, right? And so they put the mic in Stokely's face, and Stokely would say all the things, and all the fire, whatever. And then they'd come back across to King. And King was always very careful not to chastise Stokely or to say that Stokely was wrong, but he always said something different than what Stokely said, right? It was kind of a, well, you know, I think sort of thing. It was a really interesting sort of thing to happen. But the reason I bring that up is King at that time was 37, 38. Stokely at that time is 25, 26. Even Martin Luther King in his mid-30s had reached a point where it was time for the younger folks to push the movement. LeBron at this point is where King was. Jaylen Brown and those dudes, those are the Stokely Carmichaels. Like, Gabe, did you see the quote where Jaylen Brown was like, I'm a little tired of this incrementalism, you know? Like, you see the parallel, right? Jaylen Brown is saying, I'm tired of the incrementalism. LeBron James is calling Barack Obama for advice. And say what you want about Obama. I don't care if you like him. I don't care if you don't like him. Let me tell you what he absolutely is. An incrementalist, right? Like, you think about this for a second. If you're Jaylen Brown or whatever it is, or any of these cats, and we've decided that we're not playing and we're not coming back till we get something. And LeBron calls Obama for advice? Think about this. LeBron called Obama for advice on what to do after you did something that Obama would never do. Never do. Not judging him for the fact that he wouldn't do it. But that ain't Obama's get down. Obama's get down is not, we ain't coming back till y'all give us something. That's not the way he plays the game. And so these cats are out here on some, yo, we about ready to go home. We sick of this. We tired of it. And LeBron is out here telling the world, nah, but it's cool. I called Obama. And Obama said, we need to get them to make it easier for us to vote. And we need to parlay, you know, parlay it into that. Does that sound to you like something Muhammad Ali would do? And again, not judging LeBron for it. But you ain't Ali. You are never going to be Ali. And I'll be honest with you. As a matter of strategy, I don't blame him for calling Obama. But I don't know if he's savvy enough to recognize that just because he's Obama don't mean that's good advice. Like that's the part that I don't necessarily know. They needed to call somebody that's more down for a fight. Because this is the only problem I have with the thing about the arenas. And I think overall the thing with the arenas is very good, and it could ultimately prove to be a big deal, especially in a year where Arizona, Texas, and Georgia look like they might be in play, right? So you open the arenas in all NBA cities. You've just opened the arenas in Texas, Texas alone, three of the 10 largest cities in America. That's in Texas alone, all right? So I think that what they did could matter there functionally, assuming they don't get out here and start playing around with the votes. Right? Like, that's possible. Let me tell you what I think would have been a bigger deal, and this is what I think they should have forced. If your arena was not previously set to be open, why wasn't it? Make these owners get in front and explain that. And look, for example, in Atlanta, they were going to open the arena. Like, that was already the plan. They were going to open the arena. I don't know who else did that, and that was through LeBron's people, but in Atlanta, they was going to open the arena. Make them explain it, because the bottom line is, as the NBA puts Black Lives Matter on the floor and as the players are doing everything they can to try to make these statements or whatever it is, there are owners who are actively working against exactly what they're fighting for. Like, we can't ignore that part, that there are owners directly working against them. And this isn't, to me, this is not a statement of politics. This is a statement of fact. We got two parties in the United States that matter in politics, right? One of them tries their best to make the franchise as available for as many people as possible. One of them clearly has tried to restrict that franchise as much as they possibly can, all right? Now, I think both of them are operating out of self-interest. So I'm not saying who's the better people in the course of this. But the truth is, there's only one party in the United States of America that in the last 50 years, pushing on 60, has a documented track record of stopping people from voting, all right? And a lot of owners give a lot of money to those people. President got out and explicitly said that it was good for him that Black people did not turn out and vote in 2016. In Houston, for example, Tillman Fertitta, all about Trump. You can go check the money that he's giving. You can go look up all the owners and where they're giving their money. They are giving their money to people who want to make it hard to vote. Make them say that out loud. Because that's the part that's important. Make it, because what happens is these people with power can hide behind quote unquote politics, right? This is just the way the game is played. Make the owners put their names on something. Don't make the owners put their names on the stuff that they agree with you on. Make them put their name on the stuff that they don't agree with you on, and then make them explain it. Like, I'd love to see some town hall debates with players and owners to see them talk about these things and ask the owners why it is they ain't willing to come out here and say this stuff out loud. Like, that's the stuff that I think could be more powerful. That's the stuff that I think could be more important. But that move, while I think it's a good one, is of course the kind of move that a guy like Obama or a guy like LeBron would make, because it's an incremental move. It's a move within the system. It's the kind of thing rich people do. And LeBron is doing the kinds of things that rich people do because LeBron is a rich person. You know, he's thinking about how he can put this money to work or whatever it is. But he ain't trying to, like, upset the apple cart. He's trying to do more winning within a prescribed set of rules that ultimately won't offend anybody. You not Muhammad Ali if you're doing it like that. But that's how 35-year-old LeBron is going to think. That's not how 24-year-old LeBron would have thought. That's not how 24-year-old Jaylen Brown is thinking about it right now. And LeBron needs to ask himself, am I the right person to push this? Not whether you want to be the person to push this. Am I the right person to push this? And honestly, everything I've seen has indicated that the answer is no. And guess what, man? There's nothing wrong with that. It's okay if you're not Muhammad Ali. But if you keep trying to be Muhammad Ali when it is clear that you are not Muhammad Ali, you're going to wind up being like some of these other older cats who've been trying to tell the young dudes what to do, and then you wind up getting pushed out. Ask Jesse Owens what, well, we can't ask him now, obviously. Jesse Owens at the 1968 Olympics. Now, Jesse Owens was talking about something completely, like, he's way, way, way far away from where LeBron was. But in the end, Jesse Owens went down to the 68 Olympics as a hero and left in shame, left in pain, left in agony, because the young dudes didn't want to hear what he had to say. And what you don't want to be if you're LeBron is a dude that the young dudes push away. So if I'm you, empower them. Don't try to dominate them, because everybody's going to lose, including that precious image you were doing so much to cultivate. John Thompson passed away, former Georgetown basketball coach. And Gabe, I am a bit older than you. Actually, as I say that, the age gap between you and I is the same as between King and Stokely. Does John Thompson mean anything to you?
There's an image that is John Thompson, and I know everything that comes along with it. But in terms of like the experiencing as it happened, that did not happen for me.
Got you. I mean, you were 4 years old when Allen Iverson was in college, right? Yeah. Like we're asking for a lot here. And I just asked that just because John Thompson, for people of my age and older, is a towering figure, an absolutely towering figure. Now, I do not subscribe to the plaster sainthood of John Thompson. If you've talked to me about John Thompson before this, you've heard some things that I probably won't say today, right? Like, I'm not the guy that's just like, oh my God, I'm all about John Thompson. But I am all about what John Thompson represented in a lot of ways. And so this is what I want to know about John Thompson. I haven't read thoroughly enough into this. So for many of you who know this, John Thompson played college basketball at Providence. He got drafted by the Boston Celtics. He backed up Bill Russell for a couple of years. The Celtics left him exposed in the expansion draft. I think Chicago took him, and he decided at that point that he was done with the NBA, which, I mean, ain't like it was paying that much money, right? And so he left the NBA. He went and became a teacher and also started coaching basketball at St. Anthony's in the D.C. area where he's from. And then in 1972, he became the head basketball coach at Georgetown University. And you got to understand that this is like just what a different time it is that a high school coach could parlay that into a job at Georgetown. Like, especially in that area, high school coaches mean a lot. Like, Lefty Driesell got fired at Maryland after the Lynn Bias situation. Morgan Wooten, who was the coach at DeMatha, was the guy that people were looking at as the one to be hired for the Maryland job. They ultimately did not hire him, and they hired Bob Wade, who was the coach at Dunbar High School in Baltimore. You see what I mean? Like, high school coaches in that area meant something, and you could get that into a gig. But the thing about, like, going from St. Anthony's to Georgetown made a lot more sense at the time, you know, the Jesuit link. But also, Georgetown wasn't a thing yet. Georgetown became a thing because of John Thompson. Like, I always talk about this in football. It's not as hard to do in basketball, but it's still a thing. When you create a power where a power is not supposed to be able to exist, that's what John Thompson did while he was at Georgetown. Like, Michael Wilbon always makes the point that the first mid-major, like the superstar mid-major, first one was Georgetown. And Thompson pulled that off. So, like, I'm looking at it right now. Took him a couple years to get it going at Georgetown, but then 75 made the tournament. 76 made the tournament. Made the NIT the next 2 years. 79, they make the tournament. And now, before Patrick Ewing gets there, they make an Elite Eight. Right? 1980. This is pre-Ewing. They make an Elite Eight. 2 years later, Ewing shows up. And, of course, they go to three Final Fours, three national championship games in 4 years. Now, Thompson did not make another Final Four after Ewing left, but there were three more Elite Eights. Like, he built a monster program in a place where you're not supposed to be able to build a monster program. But what he did that I find to be most fascinating is he built the blackest program like ever. And he did it at Georgetown. And I'm trying to figure out how he got them white folks to let him do it. Like, he decided that he was going to use Georgetown basketball to get dudes in that probably would not have gotten into Georgetown otherwise, and that they were going to be students at Georgetown, and they were going to get degrees. Graduation rate, about 97%, I want to say, of his players while he was at Georgetown. That's one man making a decision that I'm going to open the door to get some people in a place that they wouldn't have gotten otherwise. And that is a different era of college basketball, and I say that in the sense that I believe those dudes were actually students and, like, got this done. But that was a big thing for him, was hired an, you know, get himself a new academic advisor, and we're going to make sure that these dudes get out of Georgetown what there is for Georgetown to give them. Because the money in the pros wasn't what it was. Like I just told you what the story was on Thompson, right? But he made that call. He made that decision that that was what he was going to do. And he became something that no other black coach has ever been. He became the king of a major program. Like, he is to Georgetown as Dean Smith is to North Carolina, as Mike Krzyzewski is to Duke, as John Wooden is to UCLA, right? He's that guy. He has hired every coach that's been there subsequent to him. It's his program. He runs it. And so I saw something, I mentioned this on Twitter, and I just want to talk about it a little bit more here. At the Sports Center update, I was doing Dan Lebatard's radio show, and the Sports Center update talked about how John Thompson opened the door for all these other black coaches. So where they at then? If he opened it, who shut it? Right? Because we got Thompson, we got Nolan Richardson. After that, who has even approached that level of respect within their programs and outside of it? Who else? Who has been put into a position to where such a thing is even possible? Even go look up the numbers of black assistant coaches. Everybody got to go get the black assistant in order to go do the recruiting. Go ask those guys how realistic a chance they feel like they got in order to become the head coach of a basketball program. And particularly the head coach of a basketball program that anybody wants to work at. Like a job that somebody really wants. Go look at how many of them there are. Go look through the major conference. And like when the brothers got jobs, like how many of them are just bad? But like as of right now, I don't think the Pac-12 has a single black head coach.
You wouldn't say that Leonard Hamilton's success at Florida State was the same, because you're talking about like dominant over a program where that person signifies the program.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Leonard doesn't signify that. And also, I just want to put this into context for people. As someone who likes Leonard and thinks that Leonard has done a good job at Florida State, Leonard has made the Sweet 16 at Florida State 3 times. Nolan Richardson made the Final Four 3 times. Okay, you know, like this is, I had a lot of people throw Leonard out as an example, and Leonard's done a pretty good job there. But, and this is again, because Gabe, you weren't there. The magnitude of Nolan Richardson is something totally different. Now, I think the magnitude of college basketball coaches generally is different. But think about this. Nolan Richardson went to those 3 Final Fours at Arkansas. And, you know, the way it ended with him was bad, that, you know, if they want to let me go, they can take my money, so forth and so on. But the bottom line for Nolan was, Nolan felt like Houston Nutt, the football coach who hadn't done a damn thing, was being treated with more respect than he was. All right. So like, you put this in context. Now, granted, University of North Carolina is a basketball school, right? But the football coach is never going to make more money than Roy Williams, period. When Butch Davis came in there and they decided they were going to pay Butch Davis top of the line football coach money, I mean, it was time for Roy to get a raise, because that's the level of respect that you give Roy Williams and North Carolina. And the truth is, for what the basketball program was at Arkansas and the fact that they do still want to be good, right? Nolan did not get treated with the level of respect that a white man would be treated with given the success that he had at Arkansas. You're just not, it's just not going to be that, you know? But everybody needs to look around. If they think that John Thompson was such a big deal right now, you know, such a big deal and did so much to help black coaches, everybody else need to ask themselves what they doing, because John Thompson ain't here no more, right? He can't do the job for you. He can't put you in the place that you supposedly need to be in order to get this done. And so why is it that we don't have more black coaches in these places? Why is it that when somebody gets in trouble for paying recruits, it's always a black coach that's left holding the bag, because part of his job is dropping the bags off? You know, like, I mean, I don't see any reason to believe that black people are incapable of coaching, right? I see no reason to believe or to think, why is it that white people would so be better coaches than black people? There's nothing there. The rates of participation in coaching at the levels that we're talking about here, come on, man, that's racism. That's how we wind up here. And people hit me now and be like, well, why don't you name a coach to be put up there? And that's my point. The fact that I can't name a coach is an indicator that if Thompson opened the door, somebody then came behind and shut it. So how we going? So how that door gonna get back open? Who gonna do something in that way to try to get that door to be back open? Let me know. I am very curious. because we're hearing now about these college football players and in various places and how they haven't liked the way they've been treated and all this COVID and everything else, right? Well, basketball season around the corner. I bet you're going to start hearing from some of them boys, too, about what some of these things are. And there ain't going to be no John Thompson to help them. There ain't going to be no John Thompson to save them. Ain't going to be no John Thompson to give media people interviews to help them learn how they supposed to think about those things. Ain't none of that going to be present. We going to have to do all of that on our own. So we can say rest in peace to John Thompson as we should. And we can acknowledge his importance as we should. But if you really think he's that damn important, then ask some more questions about what has happened since John Thompson left. Because he damn sure tried. You can't say he didn't try, but he couldn't do it by himself. You know? What y'all doing? Feel me? All right, Gabe. So as I talk about my birthday week, like imagine being me, right? And just how this goes. So I turned 40 on Wednesday. And I knew it was going to play out like this, but it's still cool. I turned 40 on Wednesday. And then on Thursday, an article that I wrote for Vanity Fair went up on the internet. The physical copy is not available yet, but it is a physical copy of it. The issue was guest edited by Ta-Nehisi Coates. On the cover is a portrait of Breonna Taylor done by the artist who did the official portraits of Barack and Michelle Obama. I will be honest with you about this. I used to work for ESPN.com as a writer. From 2006 to 2007, I was full-time on the payroll. And I remember the phone call that I got from my then editor, one of the few people in the world that I legitimately despise. And he basically told me that I wasn't ready for the big leagues. He just told me I just wasn't that good of a writer. And like for me personally, as many of you know, I don't care what you think about me, good or bad, you know. But as a writer, I was very young and I had skipped a lot of steps and I did not know what I was doing. I was figuring out what I was doing. And I had the job that I legitimately dreamed of having. And the guy who was in charge told me that I wasn't good enough to do the job. I haven't done a full-time writing job since. I haven't exactly looked for one, but I haven't done a full-time writing job since. Like, that stuck with me. Just the idea, not that, I mean, I thought I could be a good writer, but the idea that I wasn't a, like, big league writer. Like flunking out of grad school hurt, but I shook that off. This one was harder because I didn't really want to be a PhD. I wanted to be a professional writer. Like that was the thing that I really wanted to be. And the dude just told me that I didn't have it, basically, you know. And there's no way in the world that you could have told me in 2007 that in 2020 that like the writer that I want to be as much as anybody else, this is Coates, would tap me to write something for Vanity Fair. For Vanity Fair. You know what I mean? Like that is outside the realm of what I ever thought I was ever be capable of doing. That's like I never for a moment in my life thought that anybody from such a magazine would hit me up. And then if they did hit me up, then when I filed my copy, they would send it back with all the red in the world to rewrite it. And like that didn't happen. Like I wrote something and I think it's something that mattered and it's something that I think was good and that lived up to the standard of the publication. And like, I ain't gonna lie, man, I sat in here the other day reading and I was just smiling because like, I didn't think I could, I don't want to say I didn't think I could do that, but I didn't think I would do that. I didn't think there would ever be a circumstance under which that could happen. And it did. So I ask you, please, to go check that out in newsstands, online, wherever it comes, you know, when it happens. I would personally appreciate it if you gave it a read. And the topic that I dealt with in the piece was college athletes and what I call the illusion of power. And what I mean by the illusion of power is I think people get real charged up in like the nobility of the idea of college athletes one day realizing they quote unquote have a voice and then using that voice. And then once they use that voice, they will be able to get all the things that they want. And that's stupid. Like if you want to be honest about it logically, That is stupid. And we can give you stories. The best story, of course, of any that I can give is in Wyoming. I think it was in 1970, late 60s, early 70s. I can't remember exactly which year. But the black players on the team at Wyoming, the schools like Wyoming, they were always the ones to go get black players because who else, you know, they're like, yeah, we got to get the guys that ain't got nowhere to go, right? And so they were supposed to play against BYU. You know, BYU has been dogged by particular allegations of racism for a while, which they could specifically do because of religious differences, which then led people otherize BYU. And then it goes from there, right? But the players wanted to wear black armbands during the game. And they went to the coach to talk to him about wearing black armbands during the game. And after they talked to him about it, he put them all off the team. He destroyed the whole football program. They had to fire that man the next year. And all they did was ask. All right. Now, I understand if your argument in hearing me say that is, well, yeah, that was 50 years ago. You're right. It was 50 years ago. But the institutional dynamics that were present at that time, none of them have changed. None of them have changed. We saw it happen at Washington State, where Cassidy Jones goes in to tell Rolovich that he's going to opt out, Rolovich being the coach. And the coach says, you want to opt out because of COVID, that's one thing. But if it's because of that other thing, now we got a problem. The next thing you know, Cassidy Jones is in his apartment with no food because he can't go into the cafeteria and nobody's made accommodations for them to eat until increased stipend checks kicked up. Those aren't people with power. Right. They got to roll the dice, like to come out here and say something. These players got to roll the dice on everything in order to get it done. So, like, I think it's cool that Nick Saban and these other coaches are marching with their players, you know, on campus. But if their coaches weren't marching with them, would there be a march at all? Like, I feel like they needed Saban to be able to do it. If they march without Saban, you sure people wouldn't be out there throwing shit at them? You know what I mean? Like, you sure it wouldn't be people out there bombarding them? Like, it's great that these guys are stepping up. It's great that they're deciding that they want to do more. But do not fool yourself into believing for a moment that they actually have power. I talked to Marcia Mount Shoup. She is a minister in Asheville, North Carolina. She is married to a man named John Shoup, who was the offensive coordinator at UNC for a while, a few NFL teams. She is honestly one of the most impressive people that I've come across. Like, I just love talking to her. She's just a wonderful person. And she got her exposure to college athletics through UNC. And she made a great point and a quote I use in the article where she said, if you're saying that they have all this power, then what you're also saying is that they like the way it is. Because according to you, they got power. They got power to change it. And the truth is, man, these dudes don't have power. They do not. The only way they can exercise their power is by withholding their presence, withholding their labor. That's the only thing they can do. That's not what actual power is. There are no institutional mechanisms to come through and help them out. And that's why it's been so disturbing to me as I've watched and all these parents and everybody like, yo, want the Big Ten to play, want the Big Ten to play, so forth and so on and everything else. And this lawyer be like, well, why would we just let the kids sign waivers? Oh, my God, you're advocating for them to give up the few rights they actually have? Like, that's what you guys are about? Like, again, does that sound to you like power? And they're not a group that is in power. They are at the mercy of so many people at every turn. And we cannot, like, I just don't think we can lose sight of that. I just don't. And so I want you to check out the Vanity Fair piece for that reason. And I want to kind of segue from that to talking about what I thought was interesting with Ja'Marr Chase, Gabe. I don't know if you saw the story, Ja'Marr Chase, wide receiver at LSU, who opted out of the season.
Yeah, I saw.
Now, it's worth noting, number one, that them COVID cases is kind of on the rise down there at LSU. But they said that he didn't do it because of COVID. They said he just opted out because he didn't feel like doing it. And I'm asking this question sincerely to anybody that knows anybody that is a top prospect in college football right now. Son, what the hell is wrong with you? Why are you still there? Like, I don't know if you done seen this, baby, but them agents is throwing bags. Bags, I tell you, bags. My man Jonathan Jones at CBS wrote this. He said, one proposal I've seen had upfront cash in the high five figures with total cold hard cash over the entire pre-draft period, well over $100,000. And that's before all the benefits like housing, training, travel, and rehab. Agents can make that money back by charging up 3% fee on the rookie contracts and around 20% on marketing deals. But many agents are willing to take a greatly reduced salary fee on top of prospects. Hey, man. It's only a problem if you take the money from the agents and you still a player. Why aren't you going and getting this money right now? Look, everybody needs to understand, nothing's going to happen to your draft stock if you don't play. Nothing. And you know how I know that? Because I was in Chapel Hill when all that stuff went down and they shut that program down. The only one that really had a problem with his draft stock on the basis of not playing was Marvin Austin. And that was because Marvin Austin was the one that got everybody in trouble. And I honestly think teams were just afraid that he was stupid. Like, that was it. But Robert Quinn, he was one of the guys that they wouldn't let play all year, right? Robert Quinn was the second edge rusher off the board in that draft. Second. The first one was Alden Smith. All right? Doesn't sound like Robert Quinn fell too far in that draft. Now does it. Greg Little was expected to be like a second or third round receiver. Guess what Greg Little was? A second or third round receiver. All right. There's a couple other names that are slipping me now, but I could go through this. The guys that actually were in bad shape are the ones who played, like messed around, went out there and got hurt or something else. But ain't nothing bad going to happen to your draft stock if you decide you're not going to play. It's not going to happen. Everybody gets it. Those people aren't stupid. They know you playing for free and they know that's stupid. Because these guys, they don't got no money. Like, they ain't got to give you $5 million in order to make it worth it, right? Like, if you give a dude that ain't never had no cash a place to stay and like 40 G's, I can make 40 G's work. You call it 50, 60 G's, whatever it is. You can make that work. You can get ready for the season. You can be in a much safer COVID environment than a college campus. You ain't got to worry about all these other people. Why in the world are you there? You know, and I get it. They got them indoctrinated pretty well, and you got to look out for the team, and da-da-da, and I don't want to leave them, and so forth and so on. But I'm looking at Trevor Lawrence. I'm like, son, you are getting the worst advice. You should have never come back there. Hell, even if it wasn't no COVID, I don't think it was a good idea for you necessarily to be there. You better get the hell up out of there, son. What are you talking about? But ain't nothing in that for you to stay there. And so while we talk about these players having power, they ain't even got the power in many cases to look at their coaches and say, I'm out. They don't have power. They got needs. And one of the things they need is for us on the outside to never, ever, 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 ever forget that those guys live consistently at the mercy of their bosses. Consistently. And so, like, those of us who cover this, we need to cover it through that lens. We need to think about it in that way. Too often we think about it through the lens of the fan or through the lens of the suits that run this or through the lens of the coach. We never look at it through the lens of the players. And the truth is, the players are in situations that none of us personally would abide by if we were as talented as those players are. And so we owe them more attention. We owe them more concern, specifically because they do not have any power.
We know you can't be on top of all the news and information of the day. No need for the social media feeds. We got you. Now, if you haven't heard.
All right, Bo, this first story comes from entertainment.
Hi, this is Chris Francescani from ABC News. Last Friday, Good Morning America spoke with Giancarlo Granda, a former Miami pool attendant who says he carried on a years-long sexual relationship with the wife of Jerry Falwell Jr. Falwell Jr. is a prominent evangelical Christian leader who was the first such leader to endorse Donald Trump in 2016, and until recently ran Liberty University in Virginia after his famous father, the founder of the university, died in 2007. Falwell has acknowledged a brief affair in 2012 between Granda and his wife, but denies any involvement, and has said he and his wife have long since reconciled their differences and have a strong marriage. Yet Granda told Good Morning America on Friday that not only was Falwell aware of the affair, which Granda claims began in 2012 and didn't end until 2 years ago, but that he, quote, enjoyed watching, unquote, the younger man having sex with his wife. Grande also claimed to Good Morning America that the first time he met Falwell, the Christian leader was drunk on a bed and invited him to have sex with his wife while he watched from the corner of the room. Grande also said the couple told him that they had visited a Miami swingers club the previous night, but that it wasn't their thing and that they preferred, quote, a more intimate session, unquote. While Grande was never a student at Liberty University, the school is a prominent Christian university where students are expected to adhere to a code of ethics, which includes a prohibition on sex outside of marriage. While the Falwells came forward publicly last week to acknowledge the affair because Grande was extorting them, he tells a very different story. Grande has denied any political motivations for coming forward now as the election season heats up, but said that he is being represented pro bono by a senior advisor to the Lincoln Project, a campaign that is working to prevent Trump's reelection. The advisor was brought on by Grande's attorney, Aaron Resnick, he told ABC News producers.
Where do we begin, Gabe? Where do we begin? I guess we begin with me and Joel talk about this the other day. And Joel was like, I mean, they can't get him up out of there. And then, like, 2 days later, he turned up in the picture with his shirt pulled up. You remember that? Him and Lil Mama had their shirts pulled up.
Resigned, and then he didn't resign.
Yeah. Right. But here's the thing. He shook off the thing with Lil Mama and the shirt coming up. The problem that Falwell had is this. It's very simple. Technically, he hadn't really done anything wrong. He has not done anything wrong if this other man was having sex with his wife, right? Like, he's not the one that strayed, in theory, and it's not even really straying. They got an agreement, whatever it happens to be, so forth and so on. The details he didn't mention in that, though, was that the young man that was having sex with Falwell's wife, he also apparently got them to invest in a hostel on Miami Beach, all right? So, this is what I'm asking you, all right? If you try to explain to somebody that this dude was sleeping with your wife and you were good with it and you kept getting him jobs and stuff, right? And he got you to invest in the gay hostel in Miami. How many people do you think believe that all Jerry Falwell was doing was watching? Now that'll get you fired at Liberty, right? Like that part right there. I'm not saying it happened because I can't say that it happened. I don't know, but I know somebody thinks it happened. And if somebody thinks this happened on the board at Liberty, oh no, this got to stop. This got to stop right now. But then after he left the job, what I think was just as interesting is after he left the job, did you see where he said, free at last, thank God almighty, I am free at last?
I missed that one. Oh my God.
Yes, he quoted Martin Luther King when he finally decided that he was gone. And all that told me was he ain't never want that job in the first place.
Man, just when we needed another white guy quoting Dr. King.
Yes. Yes, but like, you know, he's not a religious guy. He's not a preacher. He's like a real estate developer. He was just always about this bread, but he's Jerry Falwell Jr. So he wound up being the one that got this gig that he clearly never wanted. He about to be like a whole different level of Al Gore. You remember when Al Gore lost the presidency and then that was the first time he hadn't been running for something in who knows how long, became a whole new person, left his wife, grew the beard, started writing all these books, like his whole steez changed up. Get ready. That's going to be the thing with Jerry Falwell. Jerry Falwell about here doing things you never imagined. He never wanted that job in the first place. Never wanted it and got stuck with it. He just wanted to be out here, you know, being freaky. Like, how bad do you have to want to get caught if you Jerry Falwell Jr. and you go into a swingers club? Because let me tell you who's in that swingers club. Somebody who knows who Jerry Falwell Jr. is. Because your thinking is probably, well, his base, they're not going to those clubs. Incorrect. They in those clubs hoping nobody see them. They might be the most likely ones to be in there. All that repression? Best way I can put it is this. I've had multiple people tell me the wildest nights they ever had in their lives were in Salt Lake City. You see what I'm saying? Salt Lake City. That's all I'm saying.
All right. This next story comes from food.
Jaleesa Castrodale. A couple of weeks ago, Michelin-starred sushi restaurant Hashiri purchased 3 geodesic domes to give customers some privacy and safety while they ate outdoors. The restaurant's general manager told the San Francisco Chronicle that he had previously attempted outdoor dining without the plastic bubbles, but it hadn't worked out, partially because of the number of people who are experiencing homelessness on the streets near the restaurant. After an inspection from the health department, the domes had to be removed for failing to provide adequate air circulation. Honestly, it's easy to sympathize with just about everyone in this scenario. The pandemic has caused so many challenges for restaurant owners who are doing whatever they can to keep their doors open, and the essential workers who are serving their outdoor customers are risking their own health to do it. But at the same time, maybe it doesn't look great to serve a $200 per person tasting menu to somebody sitting under a plastic bubble a few hundred yards from people who are struggling for basic human necessities. At the beginning of the pandemic, there were more than 8,000 unhoused individuals in San Francisco, and those numbers have reportedly risen for a lot of reasons, including the fact that shelters have had to decrease their capacities. So there are more people living in tents near Hashiri. The Golden Gate Restaurant Association told Vice that it was, quote, difficult and upsetting, and the executive director is among those who wrote a letter to the mayor recommending that city officials prioritize the availability of additional housing options, mental health and substance abuse resources, and a crisis team for mental health issues. Back at Hashiri, the staff cut the plastic sides out of the domes, and they are again seating customers underneath a modified, more compliant version.
I do think they make a good point right there. Be careful stunting on these folks. Like, she said it doesn't look good to have people eating in these domes while these other people are without homes. Yeah, not only does it not look good, let me tell you what you look like. A meal. You look like a snack. You look like a lick. You look like a come up. You look like a payday. Gabe, I have not put on that Rolex since March.
Have you seen some of these geodesic domes?
I have not.
Have you seen the Firefest documentary?
Yes.
Remember those domes, those like plastic domes?
Yeah.
They look the same.
Oh, well, actually, you know what I just thought about with that dome? I mean, it's San Francisco, right?
Yes, it is.
They went legal up there, right? Which is to say, somebody need to open a restaurant called Hot Box. And what they got is them little domes all over the place, and you can hotbox that thing while you're waiting on your food to come, since it's legal up there.
Oh my gosh.
Now at that point, that $200 tasting menu becomes a whole different situation, and I don't think that the people without homes on the street are going to be as likely to hate.
Wow.
And thought about that, had you?
I had not.
Oh man, that's a $1 million idea. I almost don't want to put it out on the podcast. How do we open up Hotbox? And somebody try to open that thing up and call it Hot Box, I'm going to tell you right now, I'm scared to hell of catching this virus. I will jump on a plane and find you. Please believe that. Everybody here knows that I am the one who came up with Hot Box right here. And you can serve the food with like a lot of spice, you know what I'm saying, to like add up on the situation, find a way to put some speakers in there, you know what I'm saying, so people can get all the sound coming from all the angles because it's round. You dig?
It can't be happening anytime soon, because if you think about vapors and smoke emanating from people's mouths, that's like exactly how the virus.
Yeah, I guess the problem that we have there is somebody would have to come into the Hot Box next. You could do this if you were the only person to use the particular Hot Box, right? But after all is said and done.
Well, what's to stop you from getting your own geodesic dome in your backyard?
Good question. I think we don't come up with something.
Yes, we have. All right, this last story is also entertainment, but on a more somber note.
My name is Brandon Obunu. The article I wrote was published in The Undefeated, and it is entitled Howard alum Chadwick Boseman Captured What It Meant to Be Black and Excellent. The article is an appreciation and a reflection on the life of Chadwick Boseman on the event of his death. And specifically, it seeks to accomplish three things. The first thing is discuss his time at Howard University and how this experience may have impacted his artistic trajectory. Specifically, the fact that Howard University is such a diverse place with a wide number of black experiences may have prepared him to portray such a wide number of kind of, you know, famous black luminaries successfully. This is something that Boseman himself has discussed. In addition, right, I discuss how Boseman might have walked the campus, for example, with individuals like Ta-Nehisi Coates. So this is a time at Howard University, like many other times, where there are a lot of talented people around. And so this very well kind of may have played a role in the way his career progressed. The second thing I discuss is Bozeman kind of on screen or as an artist. And so I discussed the fact that he was a dedicated artist, dedicated to his craft. He wrote plays. He was interested in directing. But more specifically, I talk about his on-screen kind of technical skills. And I describe a scene in 42 that's a very uncomfortable scene that's supposed to portray kind of how racism worked in Robinson's day. And it only worked because Bozeman is very, very good at the art of subtlety. He kind of can subtly put across these poignant emotions in a way that few actors can. And the last thing that the article discusses is kind of Bozeman off screen. And I try to kind of speculate on why it is that Bozeman's death has caused such an overwhelming amount of grief in so many people. What is it about Bozeman that was so enchanting? So for one, right, there's just the fact that he was well known for being a kind and generous and decent person kind of across the industry and to individuals who knew him personally, some of whom I know. But in addition to that, the circumstances around his death have kind of further informed, right, this kind of legend in the fact that he was going through this really serious battle for all of these years with an illness and, by and large, kept it close to him and his family and to a close circle of people. He didn't make it a part of his celebrity. He kind of was able to do this and accomplish a lot of remarkable things on screen. And I think this is just a testament to the kind of humble, decent, and strong person that he was. And maybe we'll never know why he didn't share this with everyone, but part of it is almost as if he needed to be strong for us, and he was, and I think he influenced generations of people because of it.
See, that's interesting. I don't know if Bozeman felt like he needed to be strong for us as much as he wanted to be strong for himself. You know, like one tricky thing about this after Bozeman has died is that we're going to ascribe a lot of stuff because he didn't tell us anything. You know, like to me, the simplest things I could say that I could take from Bozeman and dying in the news that we got is, I mean, obviously just the tragedy of the man being 43 years old, you know, and just... there's so much, I don't even know where to begin in trying to make sense of that. And the way it then wound up hitting everybody that heard it, because we just had, there was no way to see it coming. Like, it's one thing if something happens to a guy like that and it's a car accident. You know, I think it's another when you find out that they've gone through something that obviously would have involved a significant amount of suffering. And then you don't find out until the very, very end. You know, like, I think that that lands with people in its own way. And then for me, just, how could you not be wildly impressed by the fact that through all of that, that man just kept going, you know, just like, and I remember I have seen him like in person three times. One time I was actually at a bar that he owned. I think it was on Fairfax called The Dime. I was actually hanging with Coates. Coates was like, yo, we're going to be up here tonight. Come through. And I didn't even realize it was a spot because Coates and Bozeman were cool from college. And so we were there, and I remember he walked in the spot, and it was interesting because it was just kind of like an L.A. situation. Like, right, like Chadwick Boseman walking in a bar like that in L.A. is the kind of thing that happens in L.A. You know, like nobody's going to stop and like mob him. But even within that, you saw like a remarkable ease of this dude just kind of posting up and being there, because I didn't know it was his spot until he walked in. Like, not everybody knows he's the owner, you know? And so he was just in there, you know, just kind of posting. The next time I saw him was the next day, and it's not nearly as personal. But I saw him at the All-Star game, and it was funny because this is 2018. So this is like right after Black Panther has come out. And he's sitting courtside, and he's sitting, and they're going around, like, they go, Anthony Anderson. And so they showed Anthony Anderson sitting courtside. And then they showed Chadwick Boseman, and it was hilarious because Michael B. Jordan was sitting next to him, and Michael B. Jordan really didn't know how he was supposed to behave when he was the other guy in a shot like this. Like, in Bozeman, you could also clearly tell was trying to figure out how you're supposed to kick it when you are the guy in it, right? And so Michael B is next to him, and then just starts, like, patting him on the back and, like, massaging his shoulders like a Bud Dede Brown situation. Yeah, 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 exactly. Yeah, yeah, there you go, there you go. Because he's like, wait a minute, you're not looking at me? Like, he clearly, and I'm not judging him for this because this had to be an adjustment, but he clearly has no idea what to do. And Bozeman is now in this place where, like, I mean, you are the man in the biggest movie that I could remember, at least in terms of how it came, you know, when it came out. And that just kind of felt like the beginning, you know? And then the last time I saw him was at the Seaport, the studio where we film in New York. And I forget what he was there promoting, but he came and something happened. I think I said something to him in the elevator because he was there with his whole crew. And I said something to him in the elevator because it was like something legitimately funny. had come up, right? And I just kind of pointed it out. Everybody chuckled about it. And then they went out about their business. And then he came over and dapped me up on the way out. He didn't really say too much, right? Because you never know who's actually a sports fan, like who actually knows who you are. I remember he went out his way to dap me up, and we just talked for like a brief second. And I think what was wild about it, because I'm not a movie guy, right? Like, that's not the space that's going to like really land and resonate with me personally in that way. But when it came back around, I thought about it, and I was like, that 2018 thing for him really did just seem like it was the beginning. And everybody else thought it was the beginning. And there was one guy who knew maybe not. Or that one guy thought it was the beginning. Like, he was fighting. Like, we're looking at this like, oh, man, they said you had colon cancer. That means the clock is ticking. No, you don't kick it like he did, if that's the case. You kick it like he did because you're like, yeah, this is what I'm doing right now. But, you know, we're going to get through this. And then we're going to keep it going. And I don't know what the moment was for him personally where he realized that it wasn't going to go, right? Like, I don't have any answer for what that was. But I do know that, honestly, all we can do, at least as things stand right now, is guess. All we can do is imagine. And I would say for all of us personally that it is alluring, I think, the idea of deciding for ourselves what that man was dealing with and why he did the things he did. But that's self-serving. We're going to put him in a place that serves the story that we need. And especially now in a time where I think people need stories and I think that people need a lot of motivation. But we do not know, right? The part that we do know is that man did great things under trying circumstances and managed to do so without ever seeking our sympathy, without ever seeking our pity. And that is one of the strongest things I think I have ever heard of. And that I think we can all confidently say.
Hey, this is Bomani. You have reached the right time voicemail. Say whatever you want. Get creative with it. But this is your place to talk back to the show. So talk back. Peace.
All right, Bomani. So in honoring Chadwick, thought it would be a good idea to harken back to when Black Panther opened up in theaters and open up the voicemail line to hear people's experience as far as what that was like for them and what kind of a moment that was. So our first comes from Kellen.
It felt similar to how it was, and I know this might sound crazy, but like when Barack Obama got elected as president, I, as a Black man, it brought me to tears, literally, because for the first time in my life, like the idea that a young Black kid could grow up and know that they could potentially one day be president, and that's actually a real thing as opposed to just something people say. Because for so long, when I was growing up, I'm 35 now, when I was growing up, people would say, oh, you could be whatever you want, you could be president. But at that time, every president had been white. Obviously, Barack changed that. And that's how I feel Black Panther dropped, man, because we grew up with the Batmans and the Supermans, Wolverine, and we didn't have a true Black superhero for us to all grow up with. And now when Black Panther dropped, these Black kids have somebody to idolize. And yeah, it's just a superhero, but man, it's so important. It's so necessary. You know, we all need these breaks from reality, man. And sometimes, you know, when you come from certain places, you need that alternate reality, such as the comic book world and the superheroes. And that's what Black Panther was, man. It's so inspiring and so motivating for so many young kids, even adults. You know what I'm saying? Chadwick Boseman's story is so inspiring. This man was not only Black Panther and a superhero in the movies, he was a superhero in real life. And I hope everyone understands the impact of a loss of a human being like this, but I hope we become better for it in the end. I think that's ideally what a person like that, like a star like that, a true star, when it no longer shines on its own, I think it's up to us to all shine for him.
Yo, Gabe, you know what really helped me? Because again, movies ain't really my bag, right? And comics aren't my bag. So there's like an emotional resonance that all that had that just never landed with me in the same way. You know what helped me get it? when Kofi Kingston became the champion in wrestling. Now, I don't watch wrestling, but I used to watch wrestling. And I mean, you know what wrestling is for black people. It's terrible, right? But I watched how legitimately moved people were by finally having a black heavyweight champion in wrestling. And it honestly, there's a way their representation lands with people that I didn't fully get, honestly, until I saw it even mattered for people in wrestling. Regardless of whether or not I consume the medium or whatever it is, whatever the medium happens to be, people know what the hierarchy is, right? Like, they know what it is that we don't get to do. Like, we know the ceilings that people place at us at every point. And even with wrestling, we know we don't get to be the wrestling champ. Or you got to be the Rock to be black and get that. Like, we know that we don't get that. And for the superhero movies, I guess it's the same groove, you know? Like, we know we don't get that. And it wasn't just a superhero movie. It was the superhero movie with the giant budget and everything else, you know? And so I totally get in a better way now how this landed for those of you where these Marvel movies is what you do.
Directed by a black director, too.
Correct. Coogler, yes. Yes. Play the music right fast.
Thank you for your patience. A representative from the right time will be with you shortly. Your current hold time is
15 seconds.
All right, this next one, the guy didn't leave his name, but he's from Iowa, so it's an interesting one.
I saw the movie Black Panther in Iowa, and being a black guy in Iowa, not a lot of black people here. But the guy sitting next to me showed up with some Flamin' Hot Cheetos, and he was wearing Gucci flip-flops. I immediately knew that this was going to be a better experience because he was next to me. As the preview started to come on, he had his cell phone out. And the lady in front of him kind of, I guess, realized that the light was on, turned around, and was like, excuse me, sir, could you turn your phone off? The guy looked the lady in her eyes and was like, ma'am, I'm a doctor. I have to keep my cell phone on me at all times, and I have to keep it on at all times. So the lady turned around, started watching the screen again. The dude then kind of like nudged me with his elbow or whatever, and then he just goes under his breath. He's like, bro, I'm a barber. I ain't even no doctor. I'm just a surgeon with these clippers. It made the movie so much better knowing that despite being in a theater that was mostly white, I was still sharing this experience with him. And let me just say that the rest of the movie viewing experience went as you might expect it would with someone like him next to me. And that is to say, incredible.
I'm a surgeon with these clippers. Yo, such an unnecessary lie also. My next thing is, that's how you know it's a bunch of white people out there in Iowa. You know how you know? Because a bunch of white people showing up to the movie. If they thought it would just be 15% black folks, they wouldn't have come. They were like, we can go, right? Like, I mean, I don't ever see them around. Like, yeah, we can. I mean, there might be a couple, you know?
Trying to watch this new Marvel movie.
There was somebody when that movie came out that was at the house like, we said we're going to see them all, you know, then we're just going to see them. Look, we come too far to stop now.
It's got some good actors in it.
Yeah. Look, like it can't be so bad.
You remember Chadwick from 42, right? It's a strong role.
I didn't like that movie. It's not his fault, but I did not like that movie.
Neither did I. All right. This last one, the guy didn't leave his name or where he's from. But it was a good one.
The most memorable thing that I remember from that movie was I saw a screening of it at midnight the night before it premiered. And I was so impressed and inspired by the movie that I decided I wanted to raise some money and take some kids to go see the movie. So we took a bunch of kids from the neighborhood to go see the movie. And when we got there, you know, people dress up to see movies. Not all people, but, you know, some people dress up. Typically, it is not the people of our hue, but on this particular night, man, we stepped out. I saw more people who were either from Zamunda or Wakanda than I can think to count. We had, there was a brother wearing some zebra pants with Black Panther cape. I mean, afros with ticks in them. It was one of the blackest moments that I can ever remember experiencing at a movie theater where black people weren't just yelling inside the theater. So that would be the thing that I would take away most from that movie. Man, rest well to the brother Chadwick Boseman.
Yo, I ain't gonna lie, man. So I went to go see it at a screening, and I went to go see it with Pablo. Because honestly, I did not want to be peer pressured by any African-Americans into saying that the movie was better than I thought it was. I wanted to be able to take it in without... Because look, man, what nobody... What not one person... There's somebody out here. I don't know who it is. But there's somebody out here to be looking around and be like... I mean, it was all right. You know, like but you couldn't say that the first couple days after it came out. Hell nah. You might as well have said you was voting for anyway. Like you could not play that game. Like that couldn't be what you did. And so I wanted to go see it with Pablo because I would not have any pressures. I thought the movie was really, really good. I really enjoyed it. And I have to say though, I do in some ways sometimes feel like I missed out on the full negritude of the experience of going to see it with some of these other people, but I just wanted to be able to take in the movie. I enjoy going to hang out with my people as such, but I didn't feel like y'all was going to let me be me, you know? I didn't think that's what it was going to be. But it ultimately, you know, it ultimately went there. Did you go see it in Theater Gate?
I saw it here in beautiful New Haven, Connecticut.
Now, that could go either way.
Yes, it could. It's an interesting interesting situation, especially when school was in session, too. It was in February, so it wasn't quite like people showing up in costumes, but there was definitely equal representation in there.
Yeah, nah, man. So rest in peace to the brother, man. Absolutely. Ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. My man Gabe Bassane and Tarika Foster. She's not my man, but she does help handle things. Thank you. Also, thanks to our If You Haven't Heard contributors. Thanks to Chris Franciscani of ABC. Check out his story on Becky and Jerry Falwell Jr. It was wildin'. Also, thanks to Jaleesa Castrodale of Vice. Check out her story on how COVID has changed restaurant strategies. And thank you to Brandon Obunu of The Undefeated. Check out his story on Chadwick Boseman's impact at TheUndefeated.com. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. We'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.